Let me now give you the floor to Elin Wimifjell.
So, thank you very much for having me. My name is Elin Wimifjell, and I'm a researcher at Örebro University. And I will present a short summary of my dissertation, which I defended this September. When Jan told me about this meeting, he said me that it will be kind of a mix of a lot of different subjects, and I thought, like, that's perfect, because that's basically what my dissertation is as well, because it consists of four different papers with kind of different in kind of different areas. So I will try to really brief present all of them for you. Even though they are in quite different areas, they have one thing in common, you see. They all build on data from Kenya, and I used the Kenya Integrated Household Budget Survey. This was conducted in 2005 and 2006. This data consists of a little bit about 13,000 households, and they interviewed all the members of the household. So it includes almost 67,000 individuals. The data is representative at the national level, but also at the urban, rural, provincial, and district level. And even though the data starts to get a little bit old, I think it's the latest available national representative budget household survey from Kenya. I think it's one new on the way, if I'm correct. I'm not really sure. So, in the first paper, which I wrote together with two of my supervisors, Jörgen Levin and Daniela Andrén, we look at ethnolinguistic background and enrollment in primary education. And as probably many of you already know, Kenya is a really diversified country with a lot of different ethnic groups, and it exists almost 70 different languages. So what we are interested in is if children from with different ethnolinguistic background have different probabilities of being enrolled in school. And we look at the children in the age where they are supposed to be in primary school, and we only look at the rural areas of Kenya. So why do we think that this would be the case? Well, basically, we discuss several different mechanisms. For example, of course, when you discuss ethnolinguistic background, of course, language is important. I mean, if you go to school and you don't understand what the teacher is saying, you will not learn that much. And the probability that you will continue to be in school is probably lower. So that's one aspect. But we also think that these groups might share some other things. For example, culture. I mean, some of these groups have a nomadic tradition. Some are traders, some work in agriculture, which would, of course, influence the expected cost and benefit from education. We also expect that these groups might share different norms. And what do we mean with norms? Well, basically, the norm we discussed mostly in the paper is about gender. And we know that gender norms are important for if a child is sent to school or not, especially for the girls. And if these gender norms in some way are connected to these ethnolinguistic groups, then it will be relevant also in our setting. So basically, to make a long story short, what we find is that ethnolinguistic background, forget the microphone, is important for explaining the child's probability to be in school. When we look at all these different groups, two groups stand out as having a much lower probability of being in school than children from all other groups, basically. And that is the Maasai and Somali children. We also, even though our data doesn't really allow us to say which of these mechanisms are the most important one, we see some indication that gender norms seems to be important. And how can we say that? Well, basically, when we divide the sample between boys and girls, we can see that ethnolinguistic background seems to be much more important for the girls. We also see that if we look at these groups who has a lower probability of being in school, we see that this probability is even way much more lower for the girls. So we find some indication there. If I quickly move over to the next paper, there I continue with the question of education, but here we also look at child labor, or working children, as we call it. And here I'm interested in if the household's income diversification strategy influences the child's probability to be in school and or working. And what do we mean with income diversification strategy? Well, basically, we define it from which sources does the household use to earn their income. So basically, we only look at the adult in the household, otherwise we get a huge problem. Basically, a household, we only have farming households, so all households do get some income from farming. But they could also choose to diversify their income into, for example, wage labor or work on some other farm or start a business, something like that. So from this, we define different income diversification strategies. And why do we think that this would be important for child labor and education? Well, basically, we assume that the household choose to diversify away from only working on the farm if the marginal value from doing so is higher than the marginal value from the production on the own farm. Basically, what we say is that if they diversify, they will earn a higher income. This is really a simplification, because you can have other reasons for diversification as well. But if we look at previous studies, we can see that it seems like more diversified in household has a higher income. And we suppose, or we expect, that if the income in the household increase, the child will be less probable to work and have a higher probability to be in school. That's what I, in the paper, call the income effect. But we also think that it is something that I like to call the substitution effect. And what I mean is that if the adult in the household moves away from only working on the farm, then it might be the case that the child has to take over some of the responsibility on the farm. This would, of course, lead to more working children and probably less children in school. So from theory, we basically have two different mechanisms which work in the opposite direction. So we have to go to data to see how this connection works. And again, to really summarize, what we find is that children living in households that rely solely on production on their own farm are about 3 percentage points more likely to work as their main activity and about 2 percentage points less likely to be in school. We also find that the children living in households who get all their income from production on the farm work more hours. I then continue with the subjects of income diversification. And in my third paper, I look at income diversification among female-headed farming households. And the question is basically if female-headed households diversify their income in a different way than male-headed households. So why do we think that this would be the case? Well, previously research has shown that, to generalize a little bit, that female-headed households have been shown to have less education, less access to labor, less access to productive resources, and less access to credit compared to male-headed households. And of course, this will influence their options for diversification. And in the paper, we also diversify between different types of female-headed households. We look at why is this household female-headed? Is it because the head is divorced, or does they actually have a husband in the household which lives some other place? So we do it much nicer in the paper than in this short presentation. But the main findings, I would say, is that if we look at female-headed households as one group, we see that if we look at the total income, they are much more dependent on transfers than male-headed households. And of course, one explanation to this is what I just said, that some female-headed households actually have a husband but who lives somewhere else and sends money home. We cannot really say that that is the reason, because we cannot really see in the data who is sending the money. We can only see that it is a person sending money. So, but it could be one explanation. So to kind of get rid of this problem a little bit, we continue to only look at earned income. And when we only look at earned income, we see that female-headed households have a higher probability of obtaining all their earned income from production on the farm. We also see that if they diversify, they are less likely to diversify into non-agricultural wage work. And this last thing is actually quite important, because previously studies have shown that diversification into non-agricultural wage work is an important path out of poverty. As I said, my papers is kind of a mix, Irving. The first three have some kind of link between them. But then I have my last paper, which I co-authored together with my supervisor, Jörgen Levin, and which was just previously published in November, I think. And that is about maize. Or more specific, about the welfare impact of higher maize prices when allowing for price heterogeneity. So what does that mean? Well, what we look at is the short-term welfare impact of higher maize prices on different regions and socioeconomic groups in Kenya. And in Kenya, maize is a really important crop and is farmed by more than 90% of the farming households. So from that, we would expect that higher maize prices would be something good. However, most households also buy some maize on the market. So it's not really such an easy question as you might think at the beginning. And what we find is actually that about 80% of the households would be negatively affected if the price increased. And rural landless would lose the most, and the poorer household would lose a higher proportion of their income than more well-off households. However, even though I think that those results are quite interesting, I think that the main contribution with the paper is basically quite a methodological point, because if you look at previously studies on price increases in crop, almost all of them do the assumption that the consumer and the producer price increase by the same percentage. So they say, what happens if the price of maize increased by 50%, for example? What we do is that we allow for consumer and producer prices to increase by different proportions, because, of course, this will depend on the reason for the increase in the price. And we also allow for this difference between the consumer and the producer price to be different between different districts. I think it made clear in my head, at least. I hope that you follow. Yeah. And that's basically what I've been doing for the last couple of years, but in 50 minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This is really very interesting. I'm sure we'll have lots of questions related to your presentation here. So I'm now happy to invite Montserrat.
Thank you.
López Jerez. To present your work in Vietnam.
Thank you very much for being here, and I will, of course, the commentators for reading, and especially Jan for arranging it. So thank you all. My name is Montserrat López Jerez, and I am a lecturer at the Department of Economic History at Lund University, and I'm affiliated also with the Center of Asian Studies, and from July I will be a Wallander Fellow, so it's a complicated situation, but I did my thesis on the subject of economic history. So what I'll do today is mainly start why Vietnam, what is the motivation behind the thesis, somehow could even relate in any way to policies, a bit far-fetched, but we could try. What are the main findings, more on the institutional ground,
And some concluding remarks also about path dependence and colonialism. I wrote a monograph, so that's 15 minutes is a challenge, but we can try. So my thesis had a very overarching question as an economic historian, of course. It's how can the historical processes derived from the differences in factor endowments can understand the two different, or explain the two different dynamics in the rice deltas of Vietnam. So that's a bit ambitious, but I'll start decomposing it. So I'm really looking at the rice economy. So it's a selection by rice is by all means the main crop, not only for Vietnam, but for Asia, both for subsistence and as a commodity. So whatever happens in production is fundamental, and also how they will, for instance, diversify from other crops will come after subsistence has been achieved. So the thesis discussed, and as you can see from the title, is relating to this factor endowments discussion and colonial impact. And by factor endowments, what I mean is mainly man-to-land ratios, so how many people there is per arable land, and how that affects capital formation and other processes. So just very briefly, I'm sure everybody knows where Vietnam is, but what I look is that the Red River Delta, which is in the north, and the Mekong River Delta. And if we look at a picture of today, this is the Mekong, which, you know, could be California, where they also produce rice. It's actually very similar in the layout of plots. And this is a much more typical Red River Delta fragmented and cut and taking as much water as possible and, you know, all these small plots and trying to make it fit, right? So it's a very visual way of what I'm discussing, why one has ended up that way and the other is allowing for economies of scale and other important economic mechanisms. And over time, of course, I looked from the colonial period to I start with the late colonization of Vietnam, which became Indochina, so I'm talking about from the 1860s onwards. So we will be talking about Tonkin, Cochin China. Then we talk about North Vietnam, South Vietnam, and then we talk about Vietnam. So it's a lot of entities, political changes have happened. So that's kind of the idea behind the thesis, right, to cover the whole period and understand why today is different. So why is today different? Well, and why Vietnam? I mean... Vietnam is the latest miracle economy within the Asian, but it's also after China. Right now, it's going to be the fastest growing economy in the world. So Vietnam is extremely relevant for that development perspective. But also because if you were to think, and especially being Swedes and with your long-standing relationship with North Vietnam, no, the first Western country to establish a political relation with Vietnam and your great support to the development, nobody thought this was possible in 75. It was not possible almost in 1980. You know, it was amongst the poorest countries in the world. And it's a low middle income country today. So that development in itself is fascinating, just to try to figure out how this country could achieve, and not least with great support from CEDA and expertise. Peter Timmer, who was also my opponent, has... indicated that this is really an agriculture-led transformation. I mean, if you don't understand the role of agriculture in bringing people out of poverty, self-sustenance, but then also as the exporter, you know, rice is the main exporter of the country, and then we have some kind of rural industrialization happening, but it's very much a rice story to start with, we will not be able to understand Vietnam today, right? So what we see is that if we compare very quickly what has happened today from 1980s until 2006, what we had data is that as they started, this is rural South Vietnam and this is rural North Vietnam. And they started in similar levels in real capita, but we see that the South, the incomes of the South have increased dramatically, both in how much they can put in the production and how much they get in surplus capacity. But this has had an impact in inequality and poverty. So even if, of course, the starting levels were different, the impact of this growth has been greater in the South Vietnam than in the North. And again, you know, the South was the most devastated. How is this possible? So for the North, you normally explain it as, well, this initial growth in incomes is the collectivization. You know, you liberalize the
the household economy, and they're sending surplus capacity, they achieve the surplus, and they keep it, you're having this real increase. But in the South, they were barely collectivized, so it's not really the collectivization process. We see that there was some marginal lands, but this is really people intensifying land, you know, really putting some more technology into it and getting more yields out of the land, you know, really putting more effort into that. And what Ravalian and Van de Valle and Helvetz and other people are saying is that there's something in the initial conditions. You don't explain it this just by doi moi, you know, the reform, the liberalization reform. There's something before that has affected why the North and South, even today, have very different dynamics. So it's insufficient just to look at this institutional reform that happened in 86. And that's where I set myself into looking is, okay, so why was the Southern farmer more able to take the advantage of this doi moi, the commercialization process? But a similar question as an economic historian I could ask in the 1920s. Why did Vietnam, especially Cochin China, became the third largest rice exporter in the world out of very little? So why is the factory endowments interesting question? Well, yeah, when the French arrived, the northern part was densely populated. They were one of the most densely populated in the world, as it is today, Bangladesh levels. And the south, the Mekong, Cochin China, was the frontier economy. So the man-to-land ratio and that debate is very important. So what my dissertation does is it questions the explanatory power of the most relevant literature we have today, which is Acemoglu, Johnson and Robinson with the reverse of fortune thesis. And in 2012, The White Nations Fail, which of course it has become very mainstream somehow with these extractive institutions and the importance of property rights and so on. So it's like, how does that help us understand Vietnam? And in a way, it makes kind of sense because of the factory endowment stories. And Engelmann and Sokolov, it's one of the most important economic historians for this, and they were very influential for the World Bank report of 2006 of why equity matter, the equity report. And we can see how this is influencing also policy, even to a great extent, through the World Bank after 2006. So what I do is I develop an alternative analytical framework to include late colonization. I mean, this is not Latin America in the 1500s. There's a very different colonization, more indirect rule. And we have to look into both macro processes and micro processes and start thinking of history as processes of change and not something that happened in 1860. You were colonized, and then from here on you will have extractive institutions and you cannot change that. I found that slightly ahistorical and difficult to... It has a point, it says something, but it doesn't tell me how and why this case and not the other, right? So that's what I set myself into discussing. For the brief, I do try to see which institutions will be the ones we should seek. What is, if it's not sufficient with property rights, what is that we could be thinking of? And of course the question, really, should we care about history? I really hope so, because I really chose the wrong career, if not. But I think there's something that, as I said, Vietnam is a clear example where if you don't understand how they got there, you will not know the effect of whatever treatment you do. You know, there will be different outcomes that cannot be explained. So this is, of course, extremely brief. What you normally do is, in this literature, like Acemoglu and Robinson and so on, is that they say, well, the factory endowments determine colonial institutions, and from colonial institutions that determines income levels, income distribution, the inequalities of the world today. And what I say, yeah, but not completely, because if we're talking about extraction, the capacity of whoever elite, whether colonial or local, to extract, you will need to know what is the capacity of the economy to create a surplus. It seems pretty straightforward, but we tend to forget about it. So you need to understand the economics, the agricultural dynamics of the economy, and that's determined by factory endowments. And then that will determine the income levels of the farmers. It will determine, you know, and then the institutions interact. So the thesis is building these relationships chapter by chapter. So it's a very theoretical driven chapter. So if I can take the Viet Cong as a way to focus my research, well, they said it clearly. The essence of the national problem is the farmer's problem, and the basic problem of the farmer is land. So this is something we should not forget. So my thesis is very much about land. the incomes derived from land, land-land distribution, and building social tables. So I use a concept developed by Branko Milanovic and Jeff Williamson on the inequality possibility frontier extraction ratios. So, yeah, the extraction comes in relation to the economy, the capacity of the economy to produce a surplus. And that will give you a different way of seeing extraction in economic terms. So, as I said, this is a lengthy process to try to figure out even how much land there was available for cultivation in colonial times. I normally say that if you do research on colonialism, you have an abundance of material, but a scarcity of evidence. So, I mean, I cannot tell you how many days and months I spend in archives, and you think, like, why are there so many papers? This French, give me data. And nothing. So it's very creative work that I have to put myself into. So you can read it if you find it interesting. But what I come up at the end of colonial period is that, surprisingly enough, the Red River Delta, which is, again, lots of people in very small pieces of land, had greater extraction than in the south, which was the large states. Why is that? Well, because the majority of the farmers were of subsistence. They could produce very little. And whatever they could produce, there was a landlord. It's a feudal system, so they took it. So, of course, there's a lot of institutional mechanisms that I'll discuss that will change the relationships, and they could be, of course, reciprocity and whatever you want, but still they were very extractive economy. So the South, on the contrary, okay, large estates, very good. So my thesis is, well, could we say that when we talk about bimorality or this latifundia, minifundia, that's Latin America, but could be the Red River Delta, the Asian bimodality? A different way, of course, it's much more fragmented, but could it be? Maybe. And is the Mekong? What do we think about the Mekong? Yes, institutions matter. They were how they distributed land, the allocation of land, but they were also more vulnerable to markets. What would have happened without the Great Depression? Because, it's, you know, we talk about the Great Depression for us, but why shouldn't it be in economies that are extremely export-oriented? It's not only colonialism per se. Of course, the response of the government will matter. So what institutions should we care? Are they sufficient? Well, to say that colonialism had an impact is to say, I mean, how can it not? I mean, it's just, but... What else? And which institutions will matter? So what I do is I go to this oldie but goodie debate of the moral economy versus rational peasant, the open and closed village economy, what kind of institutions are when you have the frontier possible for migration. You don't have a slavery. You have forced labor, but not a slavery to the same extent, some corvée labor. So what kind of institutional dynamics and how it affects the actors, no? So if I look at the farmers. So I don't know if it's a suggestion I can give to you, but I would say that if we're interested to go back to more institutions that matter when you have a reform like Doi Moi, for instance, and you don't want, you feel also these property rights is not sufficient for you to what? get the whole thing. Ingmar Edelman, who's still alive, wrote that the institutions we should be looking at is the distribution of assets, the ones for asset accumulation and for access to market. They will interact and will determine to a greater extent how the poor benefit, how you lift people out of poverty. So if I go back to present, I said, okay, so I do 200 pages of the study over time with American presence and so on. I said, okay, is this a path dependency story? And I said, no, not for the North. It is, but because of the factor endowments. When you have even today 8 to 9 non-contiguous plots of 200 to 50 square meters, and you see that in 38, there was on average also 0.089 the land and the cultivation. I mean, how do you make a living of so little land? And still today. So do you have any incentives for applying new type of technologies that have in themselves economic scales? And what kind of cost? If you were to say, let's have an enclosure movement, let's bring land together, the political cost of bringing the land question into North Vietnam is still very difficult to get through. And economically, can you have a financial market that works where the land is worth almost nothing, but is the only asset you have? So it's very difficult to change the situation of the Red River Delta even today.
Well, the South is by far more complex. But I do not agree that it's extractive institutions. I think there was the land frontier, the possibilities of people to move, created different stratification processes. There were institutions that responded to the new changes, their conflicting interests. The Americans, with the American president, the investments they did also in the reform on the land to the tiller, new technologies. I think we can see that the South is becoming more inclusive despite the difficulties that it had. So I think it's not an easy just being colonized and having the wrong institutions from the beginning that lead to that outcome we see today. So I really don't have any policy recommendations in that sense, but you know, I think the case of this case show us the complexity, but it still gives us some ideas of where to look and this combination of institutions over time, and that if you without history you cannot understand, but history is very complex. So this path dependency, we should go back to more the Nordian way, is there should be change. We study history because there's change, not because you are doomed because you were colonizing the wrong century. So with that hope, the thesis, I hope that it brings some light into why Vietnam looks so different today. So thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. It's a fascinating story.